This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 5th of April 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 300 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll be meeting art royalty and asking it why the masses don't have a voice. Jeremy Deller will be here to tell us why he's backing a new campaign to get the UK voting in the upcoming general election.
We'll also be remembering the golden age of the record shop with vinyl junkie and music writer Richard King.
And we'll be meeting the journalist and author Darren-Anne Finn to talk about running and why Japan is ahead of the pack when it comes to devotion to the sport.
Plus, a look ahead to all the big stories of the coming week with Thomas Lewis and some Sunday listening too. That's all right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. So there we are. It's edition 300 of the Monocle Weekly, Tom.
I think that counts as a milestone.
And we were obviously going to have a collection of greatest hits, a collection of some of our big heavy hitting presenting talent on the show as well. But we blew the budget, didn't we, on a big leaving card.
That's right.
Person, of course, whose leaving card it is, doesn't know that it's theirs yet, and that will be revealed at the end of the show.
That's part of the fun. Part of the fun of the exercise.
Now, no, I know, in truth, it wasn't. It was a crate of Pizza Express's own brand lager, wasn't it?
Exactly.
That's what we spent.
You can't go wrong with that.
Exactly.
I know. Normally on a Sunday, you are sort of hitting the trails, aren't you? Your fitness regime, doesn't that sort of kick in Sunday mornings? You're usually out doing 20, 30 clicks.
I'm normally guiltily running back from somewhere. That. Yeah.
But you've been denied that opportunity because we're going to be talking about running, amongst other things, in today's programme.
Yeah, exactly.
You're looking forward to that. Do you think it might change you, Rob? Do you think you might become a devotee?
Well, do you know what?
We'll see what happens, I guess.
Yeah. Have you read a book by Haruki Murakami called What I Talk About When I Talk About Running?
I have.
And now that is the most amazing inspirational book. I was actually bought it as a gift by someone that said, read this
book. Get yourself in shape.
Yeah, you fat. No. I almost said no. By someone saying, you've always said you're going to write a book. So read this book, and it's a metaphor for whatever you want to do in life. You should just grasp the nettle and do it. I think maybe I need to reread that book, don't I? After 300 editions of the Monocle Weekly, I think it's time I reread that book.
Possibly. It's a marathon. It's a marathon of its own. 300 installments.
That is a marathon. I think I've got a bit of a stitch.
You can probably remember each and every one, can't you, Rob?
Exactly. Like notches on a radio bedpost.
Makes me feel all dirty inside.
Well, what are we going to do? Because normally in this spot, we know our listeners love your news look aheads, the famous voice of the news look aheads.
Exactly. They love to, because they tune in, and I'm basically derided each week.
And that's, it's a bit like Justin Bieber's roasting. Yeah. It's like a Comedy Central conceit.
Guiltily watching a child being bullied in the school playground.
Being poked and bullied, yeah. Tarred and feathered.
Exactly.
But this now the honour, at least for the time being, falls to Thomas Lewis, who is in our Toronto studio. He's on something called an ISDN line. I'm not going to tell you what, it's not an acronym even. It doesn't spell a single word. It's simply an abbreviation. No one knows what it means. But nonetheless, Thomas Lewis, do you hear us?
Yes, I do, Robert Bound. Good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm much, much better for you feeling so close to me, certainly. And I know Tom Edwards feels the same. It's such a good line, such a crackle-free line. I feel like I can feel your hot breath down the back of my neck.
Whispering in your ear, sweet nothings, Rob.
Exactly. Right, that's enough of this sweet chat. Let's move on to our first guest. I hope all's well in Toronto. Tell us what's going to be happening next week, however.
Well, first and foremost, I was getting a couple of beads of sweat on my brow that huge leaving card that you burst the budget on was for me, quietly, while I'm out of the country, that suddenly the budgets have been cut. But I hope that's not the case. I can feel a heavy silence coming this way. Thanks, chaps. Anyway, yes, let's have a quick look at the news then, shall we? So,
I don't know whether you know the phrase, sorry, Thomas, before you get to the seventh, the lucky seventh. I don't know, you know the phrase being sent to Coventry. You know the phrase being sent to Coventry? People might be familiar with that phrase. I think the new version of it is, why don't you become our Toronto bureau chief? I'm joking. So on the 7th
of... finally squeezed out of life at Monocle 24. Another thing I just wanted to comment on was the words, Tom Edwards, the Justin Bieber of Monocle 24, is a phrase I never thought I'd hear.
Well, you didn't actually technically hear that. But
it's an image that's in my mind now. So.
Okay.
Shall we do some news?
Yes, please.
Okay, so on Tuesday the 7th, Rob, all eyes will be on Louisville, Kentucky. Rand Paul, the senator, the Republican senator from Kentucky, is going to make an announcement. Now, we all think that he is going to announce that he's throwing his hat in the ring for the race for 2016, joining Ted Cruz, of course, who's already done so. Now, there's kind of not much information around. We do know from some reports, from some sources that haven't wanted to put their names forward in the US press, that in all likelihood he will announce that he's running, that calls have been made across Kentucky to try and get a big, big crowd there for him. I think this will sort of, you know, spice things up a little. I mean, this is going to be a very long road, as US presidential races usually are, but it's been a fairly eventful one from the Republican side already. And I think, you know, Ron Paul's voice, I was in Washington when his father, Ron Paul, was running in 2012, and he was a really sort of interesting voice, whether you agreed with his politics or not, to have in a kind of fairly crowded field of Republican candidates. And if Ron Paul does throw his hat in the ring, then I think, you know, it'll be a fairly fairly crowded room once again for 2016.
Is this Ron or Rand?
This is Rand this time.
Oh, Rand.
Picking up the mantle from his father, yeah.
So Rand. Yes. It's better than being Ron Jr., right?
That's sounds, true. That is like true.
It, sounds like it might be something else.
Don't know your Rons from your Rands, Rob.
I know. When do we think that the Rand hat might be thrown in this metaphorical ring?
On April the 7th,
April
Tuesday.
April the 7th, okay.
Just imminent. A day to go.
Very imminent. What else is happening, Thomas?
Well, it's quite a busy week, in fact. Lots of things going on around the world. Bosnia-Herzegovina will mark their Independence Day this week, which will be a big affair. Also, Budapest is launching its Spring Festival, which, you know, I can't think of a nicer place, really, than to welcome the joys of spring. Well, there's dance and song and lots of folk traditions on display, Tom, so I'm told. I am on a stipend from the Budapest Tourist Board, in case you were wondering.
What else is happening, Thomas?
Well, in London, Rob, this will be one for you. I'm sure you'll be excited for this. On the 12th of April, the Laurence Olivier Awards are being announced. Lots of the great and the good of the world of British stage will be turning out in force. Angela Lansbury is one of the star draws this year, I'm told. And Kevin Spacey, too, will be getting a special, special award from the organisers of the Olivier Awards. I mean, for you, Rob, have there been any sort of top picks from the world of theatre over the past 12 months that you think should be having their moment in the spotlight?
I don't know. I mean, I think the return fast to London stage is kind of quite a good thing. It's kind of populist theatre without it necessarily needing like a musical accompaniment. I mean, the West End stage, you know, obviously does big business. I wonder how much it brings up plays that kind of maybe need to be seen. They probably kind of stay lurking around the sort of backwaters of London and the regions, perhaps. Kevin Spacey, I guess, is the hero of the day. He'll get a huge ovation for all the money he makes from House of Cards, whether or not we still think that's a work of genius. He does pour a lot of his effort back into London stage, so he'll be the star turner of that event, I guess, and why not, indeed, you know. So yeah, that'll be a good one, and it's a big one, and it's well covered. I think the Evening Standard sponsor it, or is the Evening Standard Laurence Olivier Awards, and that's one of the events that they really do very well, and they kind of put the spotlight on lots of productions and lots of actors that aren't kind of household names and stuff. So I'm a fan of that, for sure, yeah.
And this is quite a big kind of good moment for theatre in London, isn't it, Rob? I mean, you see stories pretty frequently over the last couple of months that ticket sales are kind of going through the roof, that more people are going to theatres than ever before. So I suppose quite a nice little golden bubble for the Laurence Olivier Awards to be held this year.
Yeah, nice one. Yeah, I think there's plenty to celebrate. I think there's, as we say, there's kind of stuff that maybe needs to be on that isn't always a film tie-in or something, but it's all right. And it's kind of, as you say, people like Angela Lansbury coming. We raise our eyebrows when we hear names like that, but you know, she's been a bit of a hero. So no, it's a good one.
Shall we round off this news review with a little nod to the Easter weekend we find ourselves in?
Yes, I'm nodding. Are you nodding, Tom?
I was waiting to see whether to nod or not, depending on what
Tom fell asleep a long time ago.
I drifted away a bit there, but I'm back now with a vengeance.
So today, of course, is Easter Sunday. Tomorrow, Easter Monday, and in Washington, D.C., the big event for the Easter holidays, the Easter egg roll.
This is good, isn't it?
White House is taking place. It is kind of good fun, actually. I don't know if you've watched House of Cards when Claire Underwood is picking out the Easter eggs for the Easter egg roll while her nomination to be sort of ambassador to the UN is being shot down spectacularly. Quite a nice bit of sort of dramatic moment there. But yes, they've released the designs for this year's wooden eggs made from American oak, I think. I'm not quite sure. But anyway, but all fairly multicoloured this year, pink and green and the rest of it. And you can buy your own set, Rob and Tom, if you're still looking for Easter gifts to give to your nearest and dearest. You can even get a special edition of an egg with Beau and Sunny, their White House pets, which are printed on, which is apparently the first time this has happened, the White House website says, since the Clinton administration, exclamation mark. So that is a
all those landmark. Many moons ago. All those many eggs ago.
So what is that's a that's a dog egg?
What's that mean?
Is that what it is?
It's not shaped like a dog. It's got a nice little dog picture of Beau and Sunny.
They're Obama's dogs.
Hand carved. Yeah. Okay. They are Obama's dogs.
I favour the edible egg. Personally.
Yes, me too. I haven't stocked up
crack
yet.
Crack it open, it's got a present inside.
Perfect. Nice. Thomas Lewis, happy Easter to you, sir. Thank you very much for your news look ahead, taking time out of your Sunday lunch, your roast lamb, whatever it might have been, for joining us on The Monocle Weekly. We will hear from you next week. Our first guest on today's show is the British artist Jeremy Deller. Deller's work spans conceptual art, video and installations, among other forms, and has often married a sense of unbridled creativity with the sometimes tricky feat of incorporating political statements. Perhaps most famously in his work, The Battle of Orgreave, which used up to 1,000 people in a dramatic reenactment of a confrontation during the 1984 miners' strike here in the UK. The original event in Orgreave, South Yorkshire, was one of a series of painful encounters between the working classes and the Tory government, which split the country.
Now, Della's turning his artistic perspective to politics once again for an initiative called Vote Art. New work by Della, alongside that of four other artists, Bob and Roberta Smith, Fatima Begum and Janet Paris, will be on billboards around the UK this April, encouraging the public to vote in the forthcoming general election. The initiative is not party affiliated, it simply asks people to vote for someone. An exhibition of the project is also now open at Peckham Platform Gallery in London and runs until the 7th of May. Jeremy, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. It's great to have you on the programme. I guess that's an interesting starting point. How would you sort of characterise the problem of, I don't know what you call it, a disengagement perhaps that people have with politics, an understandable disengagement perhaps? Why is it so important to address it in your view?
Well, I was asked to do this project by Bob Smith because basically I'd do more or less anything that he asked me to do because he's the kind of person that you believe you should help out because his heart is in the right place. And I, as I understand it, for him at least, he just wanted to increase the vote, literally, have some more people voted, which is good for democracy. And I'm one of those cynical people about politics and politicians, but I'm fascinated by it. So in a way, it helps me think about voting and being a voter.
And it's interesting to me that obviously art still seems to have a power to, you know, motivate people in a way that perhaps some politicians are unable to do, which, I mean, that you could look at that as an indictment of their sort of lack of, you know, whether it's charisma or conviction or whatever else. But do you take some reassurance from this? You know, we mentioned in the introduction, you've delved into a lot of the sort of political realm before in an incredibly effective way. Is that a pleasing sort of arena to work in, to be able to explore those kind of political questions within your work?
Well, it's nice to do something that's successful for a start. So when you do something that's tricky like that and it works out okay, that is great to do. But also I think contemporary art in Britain has a very high profile compared to anywhere else in the world. So as a contemporary artist in Britain, you're probably the equivalent of a fashion designer in Paris or in Italy or something like that. You almost culturally represent your country in a way. That's how it feels. So I think you're in quite an elevated position where you can get access to the media relatively easily in the way that most people can't.
I want to ask you about you mentioned one of the posters is made by someone that is yet to vote. It'd be nice to talk about some of the artwork that's been produced and some of the sort of things that are going to go up on billboards, because it's a tough thing. I mean, there is a sort of political posters, party political posters maybe seem to be quite standard fare. They might think that they're thinking outside of whatever box they're in, but they're certainly in a box.
Well,
whereas
yes.
You've gone, you and your artists have thought very differently.
Well, yes, I'd like to think so, but what's interesting about political posters is that as soon as they're made, they can be lampooned within 30 minutes. And I'm sure every party now has a group of graphic designers and people who, as soon as they see the opposition or the enemy's posters, they come out with their version and just bang it out and put it online, which is quite interesting. So there's these sort of rapid response units. Whereas with our posters, hopefully won't have that happen to them because they just use the word vote. in different ways, graphic ways, on the whole. So they're very simple, actually. So, for example, my one is just, I don't know if you've seen it even, it's an image of Stonehenge, but actually the stones are arranged to spell the word vote. So it's a very simple idea. It's really, you know, simple advertising, basically. It's this kind of thing an ad man might come up with to sell whatever. But I felt it was effective and witty. I hope it's
Well, is it? That's the question. Well, that's the $64 million question, is if I were going to pay you that much. I'm the guy from Kraft Foods. Mm. And, I mean, do you think that the poster's your poster? Does it riff on the values of advertising, or does it riff on the values of ours?
Well, it riffs on the value of the image of Stonehenge, which everyone knows almost worldwide. Literally, it's probably the most...
That's a rights-free image, Jeremy Dellen.
I think it might, hopefully. I don't think the architects are around anymore.
I think it's all right, you're right.
But so it's probably one of the top three best-known buildings in Britain. And everyone knows what it is. No one knows what it was... Well, most people don't know what it was there for. Yeah. Some people believe they do, but that uncertainty around it is good, which means the ownership of it is wherever. And you can project your own ideas onto it. So I suppose I'm projecting a word onto it. And a very simple word. If we want to get, I suppose, a little bit more serious about it, Stonehenge was a place of, we assume it was a place of communal happenings and of people coming together to do something together. It's not really clear what. So it was a place to gather around something. So I wouldn't say it was a political place, but it was definitely a place of meeting, and which is, in a sense, carried on with the idea of voting and political meetings.
We'll have on May the 7th. Jeremy, what about in terms of the creative process? And Robert sort of alluded to this already, this idea of, you know, it's in the place where we would see advertising traditionally, not a work of art. How do you approach projects, you know, knowing that that's going to appear on, you know, a billboard in the street? What's the sort of discipline? Is it a different creative process for you than if you're creating work that you think people might see in a gallery or in a private home or something like this? Do you tackle it in the same way, or is it the same sort of processes that go on?
Well, obviously, if something's in the street, it's going to be seen for less long. It might be passed by a car, so you might get a second or 2 seconds of someone's time. Well, you might get a bit longer, obviously, if they're walking past or looking at it. So it's got to be something that has an immediacy to it that you might not necessarily want to live with in the way that you might want to live with an artwork or another graphic that you might make. And you're there to make a point very clearly, and to you're selling an idea in the sense that all art is, in a sense, selling something, in some sort of idea or theory or whatever. But this is a very direct, it's a means to an end. So it's actually a very clear brief. It's basically it's advertising for an idea.
And I wonder how this, when we heard about this, it seemed like something that was natural for you, knowing the work that you've done. Mm. Does this feel like another part of your career involving others? It's been something that you've done, you've been famous for. Do you find that easy? Is that, or has that always been part of the plan?
My skills are not in the traditional realms or regions that a lot of artists have. So I do work with people a lot because I feel that's something I'm capable of doing.
Yeah.
And I quite like my work being outside galleries, but also I'm quite interested in Stonehenge. So in a way, it combines a number of different things that are of interest to me. I'm also very interested in politics, even though with this specific campaign, I'm finding it even almost too stressful to sort of watch and take part.
Is it frustrating to be having to be apolitical for this?
Well, I mean, a lot of people know my work anyway, so it doesn't really matter. I'm not at all. Mm. Not really. It's good to do that sometimes. It's a good challenge not to try and force your opinions on people. It's nice.
Jeremy, can I ask you a bit more about the way that people could then consume not just this work, but your other work? You mentioned the idea about things that are not necessarily for consumption, you know, in a gallery setting and that kind of thing. Do you think that there's maybe too much emphasis? I mean, do you ever feel there's too much emphasis put on, you know, the marquee shows, what's getting the footfall this year? Is that a pressure that you ever feel, or are you not really interested in?
Not for me. No, it isn't. I'm in a position where I don't have to worry about those things. If I was beginning a career and struggling in a career, maybe, then it could get to you. But luckily, I'm very luckily, I'm not in that position. But the whole structure of the art world and the market can be quite stressful when you think about it or take part in it. And I'm sure for young artists, it's sort of exciting, but it's absolutely terrifying at the same time.
Was that the same, or do you think that's changed? Are we on a bit of a shift in, I don't know, generational shift in that?
It's
sort of
become
thing?
More like everything, like the property market. It's just become bigger and more money coming into it and more money sloshing around. So it's become a bigger thing because there's more rich people in the world and they're spending their money on art. So it's changed the nature of it, which is good. It is good. It has to be good, really, in a way, but it has its pitfalls. Just have to be aware of it. Mm-hmm. and know, be confident about where you stand within it.
So I was wondering whether the, you say there's more rich people, they spend their money on art at the moment. Do you think that filters down? I mean, when we think of a certain generation of artists who all maybe railed against a system, but a system that still at that stage funded them to do things. Mm. And I think that that seems to be sorely missing. And I wonder whether that, whether we'll have another generation, or whether they'll have to think about market forces. They'll have to think about selling their degree show before they can think about having a career almost. Well, do you have a point of view on that?
I think maybe the trend might be for artists to move out of London.
Yeah.
So there'll be other art scenes, which is probably a really good thing.
Yeah.
In opposition to London, or just very different from the London art scene, where you don't have to make a lot of money to survive. But there'll always be a very broad, you know, the art world is a very broad church. You just hear about a certain aspect of it because it's the glamorous.
We hear about the expensive. Top 1%, I guess. Don't we?
Yeah, exactly, like anything.
Yeah.
So there's tons of other things going on underneath it, people doing all sorts of things.
And I wondered in terms of, I mean, this project is about getting as many people to vote as possible. It is about engagement. And lots of your works have been about that. And in terms of museums and things, do you think they can also be judged in terms of their engagement by the amount of number of people that go through their gates?
Well, for them, it's important to get a lot of people. Visitor numbers are very important. I don't know if it's actually tied to their funding, but it's very closely observed and looked at when funding rounds happen, when they know how, if they think that their visitor numbers have gone up, and that's a good thing. And the participation in British museums is very different from it is if you go to France or most places in the world where museums are usually.
But there's less of a pressure on that.
Yeah, they're usually quite quiet.
Yeah.
But you go to museums in Britain, on the whole, in London, they're busy all the time, which is actually a great thing.
It's a lovely thing to see, but it's sometimes a bit frustrating when you're trying to check one particular thing.
Depends
out.
On the show.
Yeah, yeah.
It's great at the British Museum because there are big objects that people are around and kids are running around. But if it's a little quiet painting show, you don't really want that necessarily, those numbers.
But maybe the general gist, I mean, this is, and of your work and of the thing, is that actually the more people that see this stuff, the better. And if you have to wait your turn to see them, that might be just part of the success of a particular building, a particular program.
Yes, and also the more people that see museums, go to museums and see art, will support it in the future. And those young people become politicians and they'll understand the value of it. So, you know, you hope it's a good thing for the country. And not an exclusive thing like it can, you know, in America, it's quite an exclusive pursuit still, museum going.
Because the ticket price is expensive, it's not free, it's, yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess that's where, you know, coming back full circle to the sort of the power of, you know, the collective experience, the power of participatory, you know, democracy, if you like, and coming back to what vote art is all about. Are you reassured by the reactions you get from people when you talk to them that this can have an impact? You know, if we look at May the 7th, turnouts don't go where you and your colleagues working on this project would like them to be. I don't know. I just wonder what your response was. If they're sort of, oh, you know, record low levels of turnout, if people seem to be, you know, if they express their disillusionment with particularly the mainstream parties by simply not turning up, how damaging will that be, do you think?
Well, you want a high turnout. I think we want a high turnout regardless, but it's, who knows? You can see why people are disillusioned. So I don't know. This will be an election like no other, as everyone has been saying. So, but I think the turnout will be quite high. I hope so.
Well, Jeremy, thank you very much. For Londoners, the exhibition runs at Peckham Platform until the 7th of May. Everyone else can find out more about Vote Art at voteart.co.uk. For the time being, Jeremy Deller, thank you very much. Time for some music now. This is from the recent BC Camplight album, Perfect Sunday Listening, if we do say so ourselves. This is Should Have Gone to School.
That was US Troubadour by way of Manchester, UK, BC Camplight. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're talking more about music and record shops, specifically after this.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our Bureau Chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
with one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network. New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his reports across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
Richard King is a writer whose love of words, music, and more specifically words about music, means that when he puts pen to paper to muse on the magic of pop, people sit up and listen.
His 2012 book, How Soon, is now charted the unusual individuals who shaped the indie music scene in the UK. And his follow-up, new book, Original Rockers, looks further into that scene, telling the story of his time working in Revolver Records in Bristol. This was a time when the record shop was still king of the high street, a place where music and more than a little snobbery about its myriad genres could make a reputation.
Richard joins us now to tell us more about the book and that bygone era. Richard, thanks for coming into the programme. We're kind of talking about a golden age in original rockers, aren't we? I mean, you know, the record industry in terms of record shops, in terms of people having arresting kind of posters in the window in front of, in terms of knowledgeable staff, in the case of it kind of being a gang that everyone wanted to join.
Yes, that's absolutely the case. The shop I worked in Revolver had staff that included Daddy G from Massive Attack, yeah, who met another member of Massive Attack at the other side of the counter. The pop group used to hang out there as schoolboys. Me and my friends were in bands of a slightly diminished stature, but ones that nevertheless had record, yeah, deals. And it was a place where people wanted to visit, not with no intention of buying anything, just to stand around there and talk and spend time. And this was a period of time when people could live in cities like Bristol for very little money and feel that they were having an incredibly high standard of living by hanging out in places like Revolver.
Richard, can I ask you about that, though? I mean, I don't want to sort of repeat this oft-quoted thing that, you know, it is the end of an era and that, yeah, you know, the sort of record shops are gone and digital's ruining everything. But do you think that sort of, I don't know what it is, almost that community, is that something that's hard to recreate? Can that still be the same now? Everything is a lot more disparate, isn't it?
You know, part of writing the book was wanting to celebrate the final dying cry of the out-and-out music snob. It's someone who's learned everything through hours of poring over esoteric records in strange places. It's, you know, I'm sure every interview you do here, someone says it's all online now. But the fact was that this was a place that had secret information. So although, you know, there's an argument about analog versus digital, I think it's also about time and how people spend their time. And if you're prepared to invest hours in what most people possibly rightly dismiss as nonsense, that can't be repeated. And I think the other thing is, it's really hard to be a shop these days. You know, estate agents call boring suburban streets villages if they sell muffins and, you know, baby's clothes. And those shops have to sell things at a certain price. But a really good record shop used to have records for sale for a pound. And the only places on a high street that can sell things for a pound now are pound shops. So it's to do with the sort of onward march of the changing face of the high street, I suppose, as well. The idea that a really good record shop that sold secondhand and new releases and, you know, allowed a sort of element of time travel just by walking through its doors, the economy isn't set up in a way to allow that anymore.
You use a really nice phrase near the beginning of your book when you're talking about whether or not you're going to buy a new hi-fi system, and you say, you talk about your record collection and you have sort of almost baring its teeth from the shelves. You say it's got a latent sense of purpose. Did you owe it to your record collection to write this book as much as to the record store?
I think I owed it to my family, who put up with a wall of
the heaving shelves.
Yeah, exactly.
Because each of those has a personality. Each of those has a history. The spine, let alone the cover, is reminiscent of something.
Exactly, and I'm of a certain age now where someone who I never knew possibly lived in a different country, who wrote their name on a piece of in a biro on the back of the record, that suddenly has a significance. I can't really explain what that significance is, but the idea that these objects are now 40 or 50 years old, some of them. A totemic, the only way I can explain is if you're into records, you know exactly what I mean.
Yeah.
If you're not, then you probably think it's a very strange idea to attribute disintegrating records with any sort of significance other than the scratchy music they play.
Richard, what about the music, scratchy or otherwise? Specifically, what was your kind of musical journey? Did it come from reggae? Was it about the music you wanted to play in your bands? Or what was the sort of, what were the key drivers? What was your sort of musical narrative like, I guess?
Well, I think, you know, Bristol's quite a sleepy town. It's not a place like Manchester or Glasgow where there's necessarily a place where all the bands get together to talk about music, to have an element of one-upmanship, to trade instruments or whatever else bands used to trade. And one of the charming things about the sort of soporific qualities of Bristol is people are very passive and modest in their creativity. It's not aligned within the city itself. It's always, the narrative is always provided by London usually, or certainly that's what happened with Massive Attack and Portishead and Tricky. So being there, one wasn't aware of the riches around one, but there were certainly things like sound systems, bass parties. Also, it's really hilly, Bristol. You can walk around the city, but you feel quite tired when you get to your destination. So it's a place where people are quite relaxed, you know. And
I love how these things play into it.
Well, it's not an in-your-face city, you know.
And there's bands that could never have come from Bristol. The bombast of some of the bands from Manchester, from London, maybe. Yeah,
it doesn't have that assertiveness or ambition, occasionally to its detriment. Yeah. But when music travels from the city, I think people really relate to those qualities. But going back to your question, sorry. You know, Bristol's one of the only city apart from London that currently has an elected mayor, and he really wants to celebrate Bristol, the cultural heritage. But something like Massive Attack's parties when they were the Wild Bunch happened as a result of something called community policing after St. Paul's race riots. And that meant Massive Attack, the Wild Bunch as they were then, could play sound system parties till they felt like finishing on the corner of their street. And they wouldn't get hassled and their equipment wouldn't get impounded. Now, that's not going to happen today. But that was the culture of the city at the time. So people felt that they could always walk a few miles or down the road and be in the middle of something. But one didn't really know what to call that thing. And I think that's always when interesting music is produced, when people don't know what it's called yet.
Presumably that is the case. When a record shop is a record shop, and you don't have to be wary of the different genre tickets in the shelves, right?
No, we like to invite our own genre, invent our own genre.
Yeah, because that was something I wanted to ask you about. I mean, about how record shops fitted and Revolver specifically fitted into the kind of like the music industry ecosystem. You know, how I wondered actually whether you thought that record shops could make as much different as labels, as tastemakers, as scenes.
I think every grumpy man behind a record shop counter likes to think they can. I have friends who run a shop in Glasgow called Monorail, which is one of the very best record shops in the UK. And certainly they it's a deeply problematic and overused word at the moment, but they curate their stock to the extent that I think they have a huge influence on their city, more than the media probably. And something Revolver did was it sold secondhand as well as new releases. Yeah. And people would wander in having read about something in Enemy, maybe, but there's every chance they'd leave with a secondhand Marvin Gaye record. And they hadn't got, you know, the market had sent them in for something and the media had sent them in for something. And they left with something that had a very different sort of value. And working in the shop, I think we always thought that was a result and a sort of intervention in the culture. And if someone left with the record they hadn't intended to purchase.
How did that intervention take place?
Well, there's often...
Did you bully people?
Swearing.
Richard. I like the kind of bully that changes someone's perception to this extent that they come in wanting, you know, I don't know, Delta 5 and walk out with Marvin Gaye. That's
a
good thing.
Well, they Delta 5 have been allowed. Yeah. I don't want to disparage any bands, but this was just before Britpop, so I'll leave it to your imagination. But I didn't shout at people. I was too sort of sullen and shy to actually engage to that level. But certainly the owner of the shop, if someone put a record down he didn't approve of, he'd pick it up in his hand, look at them, he'd say something like, "Loved only by their mothers." turn it over and say, I'm afraid I can't sell you that. It's a rubbish record. You know, go and buy something more interesting.
Well, tell us about how edited the stock, your stock was then in Revolver, because you had a bit of sort of economic responsibility to stock something that was vaguely popular, but you didn't necessarily all agree on.
If only we did. No, I think our stock was edited by the distributors who regularly put us on stop for not paying our bills. that was the key factor. No, we had some quite strange suppliers. We had sort of Britain's leading free jazz distributors who were based on the islands in Orkney, and they drive across Britain in a Morris Minor with a car full of free jazz. And we were probably their last point in their round trip. And by then they'd been broken by this fairly pointless journey trying to encourage shop owners to buy Derek Bailey and Evan Parker records. So we used to get very good deals out of them. We got 4 or 5 boxes original ESP vinyl. It's a New York free jazz label that put out records by Sun Ra and Ornette Coleman and Don Cherry and people like that. And we had a stock of those that just sat there because we wouldn't think about selling them. We just loved the idea that they sat in the back room. And in the back room we had, we had an entire other shop's worth of stock.
I was going to say, it's a bit Mr. Ben, right?
Absolutely.
If you put the entrance in the back door rather than the front door, would Revolver have been a more or less successful shop?
It would have been far, far, far more successful than that. We had records we could sell and people wanted to buy, but we weren't willing to sell them.
Yeah.
So people had to make do with the rubbish out front, you know, unless they'd put the hours in and tolerated the abuse and generally proved that, you know, they'd never read the music papers ever again, then we'd take them seriously.
Richard, what happens when you see things like independent record store days and all these sort of really contrived efforts to sort of coax people into the, you know, the few shops that are still battling? Does that make you depressed? Do you sort of feel, well, actually, you know, there's still some kindred spirits out there? Or, I mean, I don't know, do you see that as a sort of a front in a losing battle, or is it wrong to characterise it in that sort of way?
How long have you got? I have friends who run shops in Wales, in towns where there are no universities, and they've struggled for the last 5 years. And they'd say, record store day is all very well, but once I add it all up, we make a pound if we're lucky, and it's a lot of work. Then my friends who run Monorail in Glasgow, if record store day didn't exist, they could probably invent something of their own and it would be even more successful. Record store day, I think, is a little like an app. It's sort of record shop, so there's an app for that, and that's record store day. At my most politest, I'd say, at the moment, record store day is perhaps more about record store day than the record shops. For the first 3 years of record store day, the major labels weren't involved, and now I think it's safe to say they've rather taken over.
Is that really one of the problems, that they will find a way to sort of, you know, influence these sorts of things or try and influence them?
I think they're...
Or does that happen?
They're organisations that are set up to do that, aren't they? You know, they're companies that whose raison d'etre is to achieve market share at the cost of their rivals. So, you know, Record Store Day isn't spared that business model. I know lots of shops that are full of people who moan, and, you know, may they always be full of people who moan, because I think that's part of the job description if you're running a record shop. But I worry about a one-size-fits-all approach, because I'd like to think the shops that still survive all survive partly because they have such individuality. And the received idea that Record Store Day sorts everything out just absolutely no longer applies.
Well, there is that and much more further reading and wit and wisdom in Richard King's brilliant book, Original Rockers. It's out now. It's published by Faber and Faber, who are having a brilliant time with their music books at the moment. Richard, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
What makes for a good piece of chocolate? From minimal to maximal, Monocle Films meets the melters and the sculptors reshaping our chocolate expectations.
Having a culture that's so vibrant and lively and just colorful, I thought of incorporating the flavors of our background into the chocolate. So we use a black salt that's from the Himalayan mountains. We use rose water. We use coriander, fresh coriander seeds that are roasted into our caramel.
Our little cinematic ode to chocolate is now playing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
It's Sunday, and you may well just be catching the tail end of this show on your headphones as you dash across dew-sprinkled woodland with the nimble grace of a startled deer. Because one pastime that many people enjoy on a Sunday is a good run.
Running is that most simple of activities, or so it seems that most of us can enjoy one foot in front of the other, right? Well, some give it a little more thought than that. People like Adarinand Finn, the author and journalist whose reflections on the human urge to run have produced celebrated books such as Running with the Kenyans, Sunday Times Sports Book of the Year in 2012. And now Finn is picking up the literary pace again with The Way of the Runner, a book reflecting on the mindset of runners in Japan.
Finn moved to that country with his family to investigate the Japanese relationship to long-distance running, known as Ekiden, to see how the sport affects not only individuals, but a whole nation. And Adarinand joins us in the studio. Welcome to the programme. It's a great idea for a book. Maybe you can tell us what kind of sparked in your head. You went to Kenya, you did that whole thing. What sparked in your head the fact that the Japanese were so good and maybe so interesting to study?
Yeah, I mean, I'd been to Japan about 12 years ago and had no real interest in running at that moment in time. I had done as a junior, but at that moment I was not running at all, and happened to come across an Ekiden and just stood by the side of the road watching it and thought no more about it. Later on, when I got more into running, I kept hearing about this unique running culture in Japan. And it's unique in various ways. So one way it's unique is that the biggest races are these Ekidens, which are basically long-distance road relay races. In essence, what they've done in Japan is they've taken the very individual sport of long-distance running and turned it into a team sport. So that was instantly intriguing.
It's an interesting thing. You make that point in the book very eloquently as well, that, yeah, I mean, you know, it is famously the loneliness of the long-distance runner, unless you're in Japan, right?
Yeah, and then you're fighting for the team. You know, the whole dynamics change. And also, as a spectacle, it's different as well, because as the race is progressing, suddenly a weaker runner takes the baton, or the taski, as it's called there. They have this ribbon which they pass from runner to runner, and a stronger runner takes that leg, and then they move the team up. Or occasionally you get some guys come right from the back to the front. He overtakes the entire field, and, you know, the drama and the excitement of that is brilliant. And then the next runner is not so good, and they go back again. So that's one element which was unique to Japan.
Yeah.
A second element is that they have the only salary men and salary women runners in the world. Most runners, even, you know, people like Mo Farah and stuff, they're not on a salary. They're earning sponsorship money, they're earning prize money, appearance money, but it's basically a freelance, you know, and you're only as good as your last race kind of position. Where in Japan, these teams are set up by the big companies, Honda, Toyota, Konica, Minolta, and lots of the big companies have set up running teams, and they employ the runners. They scout the universities for the best runners.
Okay, so this is like, you know, maybe a college sports team in the US. They pluck people from obscurity to be part of that university, to be on that baseball team or whatever, basketball team. So it's a bit like that. So these people aren't one, they're not fixing car parts for Toyota and then at lunchtime putting on their shorts and running out
of
the building.
On the big teams, they're not. On the big teams, they're full-time athletes.
Yeah.
But the further you go down the chain, some of the smaller teams who are still competing in the national leagues and stuff, they do work part-time in the offices as well. So they train in the morning and then they go into the office for maybe 4 or 5 hours, but they get to go off early for training. One company I went to where they had this situation, they kind of purposely spread the runners around the different departments. It didn't really matter how good they were at their job. They're there to kind of, they're for the morale of the workers, for the workers to feel like they support the company, you know, and give them something to cheer. And so it was nice for each department to have one of the team working in that department, and they'd get rotated around.
There's amazing sort of culture, and you get to the heart of some of it there. I just wonder, with this sort of running culture and whether this lived up to your expectations or not, because, you know, we hear about the sort of legendary preparation, the attention to detail, the sort of fastidious approach to running and training. But are the Japanese actually good at running? Because you make this point, you sort of frequently come back to it, particularly with your comparisons to the Kenyans and their ethos, that maybe actually, you know, the Japanese, they have incredible success rate at getting, you know, lots of runners doing very fast marathon times, for example, but they don't sort of challenge consistently other distances. Is some of their culture maybe holding them back a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very delicate area to go into, because obviously the Japanese are very strong in their belief of what they're doing, and this book is being published in Japan, so it'd be interesting to see how it goes down there. But because it depends where who you compare them to. You compare them to the British, I mean, they're incredibly good. So there was a race the other day. It was a university half marathon championships. 265 men ran under 66 minutes for the half marathon. Now, that might not mean much to some people, but that's very, very fast. So 275 men. In Britain, up in the whole year up to now, only 6 men have run that fast. So you've got 275 in one race. So I was comparing them to Britain. I think, my God, what are they doing? Why are they so good? When you get there and you see how it evolved and developed their running culture is and how much effort they put into it and how many professional runners there are there, you start thinking, I can see why they're good, but then why are they not better? Why are they not competing with the Kenyans? And the dynamic is particularly interesting because all these company teams have one or two Kenyan or Ethiopian runners in them who they scout from Kenya and Ethiopia to, you know, kind of boost the team a little bit. And these Kenyans and Ethiopians are very fascinating to talk to them and their views on the Japanese training. And they all think the Japanese training is terrible. And the reason they think it's terrible is because they think they work too hard. They train too hard.
There's a guy you speak to in there who says, if the Japanese trained like we do in Kenya, they'd be setting all the records and winning everything. Yeah, I can't remember which of the Kenyan athletes that was who you spoke to, but he was stunned by the overwork.
Well, he was initially stunned by the level of support that runners had and the level of interest in running. So that's why he said they should be better. I asked him, why are they not better? And he said the training and they train too much. I mean, I don't 100% agree with him because the Kenyans have got quite a few natural advantages, such as the high altitude and the fact that they're all running around from the age of 2, barefoot, running long distances. It's very, very physically hard upbringing that just prepares them for long distance running. But at the same time, it was very interesting to kind of twist that question on its head and say, why are they not better? And I think this overwork, particularly at a young age, because you talked about university runners, but high school sport there is just as popular. And the high school Ekiden races, so these are 17, 18-year-old guys. These races have been televised nationally, huge audiences and huge pressure. And the coaches are very overbearing and they really put these guys through the mill. And lots of the older runners you spoke to, they all said they hated running at high school. And so this means there's a high burnout of both talented runners and probably the most talented have been the most pushed. So they're the ones most likely to burn out physically and mentally. So, you know, you get these guys, they just didn't enjoy it. They give up when they get to university, even though there is this potential career path in running.
You mentioned that these the high school races are televised and all the rest of it, and you talk in the book, I think some of them get like a 10% audience viewing share, which is kind of incredibly high. I doubt that the London Marathon, it's on BBC One in a couple of weeks' time, right? That won't get a 10% audience share, I wouldn't have thought. But I mean, it's an incredible thing. Tell us a little bit about the media coverage, because it's an amazing thing to be for us in the UK and for all our international listeners to kind of probably understand the scale of this.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually the biggest Ekidens get like 30% audience.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
like, and these are people running along with a Toyota banner on, and it's not like they're sponsored by them. They happen to be running for that team. Ordinary, and this extraordinary.
This is not like the London Marathon. A lot of people watch the London Marathon because they know somebody who's running.
Yeah.
You know, there's 35,000 people running, so everyone's got a connection to someone who's running. Whereas in these big Ekidens, there's actually only like 20 teams. So at one time, there's only 20 runners running. So it's a very much a high level elite competitive sport. So they're watching it for quite different reasons than we are. So they've got this interest in running as a sport. And there's various reasons behind that. But one is the fact that the media have been very involved since the beginning. So after the Second World War, these Ekidens began, and lots of the biggest marathons in Japan date back to that time, which is completely...
This is to kind of build companies, build morale, build togetherness.
Exactly. Yeah. Bring people together and rebuild morale. And it was part of the rebuilding process. We thought if we get these running teams, running's a good character building sport.
You don't need much equipment for
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Yeah, we haven't got much going for us at the moment. But they were all put on by the newspapers. And newspapers in Japan are huge. I mean, the biggest newspapers in Japan still get subscription, daily readerships in the millions. You know, compared to here, it's huge. And they're still running all these races, which means they get, right from the beginning, they get a lot of coverage in the media, particularly, and now the television companies are onto it. So that in part is why they're so popular. And the other reason, I think, is because the Japanese really value hard work, teamwork, you know, kind of perseverance, people who really put effort in, and they really feel the effort that the runners are putting in.
Can I ask you a little bit about that sort of cultural difference? Because some people say, oh, good, you know, you enjoy distance running, it's punishing. And, you know, a lot of keen runners say, oh, it's actually not punishing, it's about something much more sort of fundamental than that. But what's certainly quite punishing is, you know, going with your whole family and doing a sort of immersion therapy in a culture that's so very different. Not only that, but also travelling by land to get there. Are you just a bit of a glutton for punishment?
Oh, goodness. I mean, I didn't expect it actually to be as difficult as it had been. I'd been to Japan many years ago and had a great time. And one of the big issues in Japan is, I mean, there are cultural barriers to get across, and people are a little bit like they want to make sure they don't jump into things. So everyone's a bit reserved and a bit keeping their distance. But the language was a main problem. And I think I got a bit cocky thinking I'd be able to learn Japanese in, you know, the 4 months I had before I went to Japan. And the journey there, I mean, it was a wild adventure. I mean, we did slightly maybe bite off a little bit more than we could chew with three small children for a week on a train in Russia. But I don't know if it's a glutton for punishment. I just kind of felt like, you know, let's do it. Let's do this properly, you know, and you know, we'll see what we can find out, because you can read as many books as you like, but from one like experience of being there and spending time with these teams, you get a real sense of, you know, what's going on. And also they then once you're with them, and especially because I run as well, and I'm running with the top teams. I mean, I obviously struggle to keep up. I mean, they're very good, but that kind of breaks down barriers as well. They stop seeing you as a journalist and see you as a runner, and then they kind of, you know, that helps as well.
And did you at the beginning of the book, you are talking about beating your personal bests, and you're wondering whether you should welcome the time at which you can no longer get any faster and you can just be a chilled runner that actually enjoys going running. Did running in Japan teach you to enjoy your running more, or were you kind of running out of fear? Was it carrot or stick, I guess I'm asking?
The problem is I do keep getting faster. I mean, I just ran my two best, my best half marathon time, my best 10K time in the last few weeks. And I just feel like, although I do enjoy going off for a run and just being out in the countryside, there is something about pushing yourself and trying to keep getting faster and learning. It's almost like a study. I always feel like it wasn't really my intention when I started off back before I even did the Kenyan book, was to kind of study running. I was more just intrigued by why we do it and what the motivation is. But what I've found is that I've ended up studying. Running, like you said at the beginning, is a very simple sport, one foot in front of the other. But actually, it's a real skill as well. And that's one thing I think particularly, it's quite a recent idea that you can learn how to run and that there's a particular way of running. And I've been learning a lot about that from the Kenyans and from the Japanese, and not always how to do it, sometimes how not to do it. But so I've almost feel like, I'm on this process, and until my body kind of reaches that point where it can't go any further, I'm just going with it.
Run until breaking point.
Well, the book is fantastic. It's called The Way of the Runner, A Journey into the Fabled World of Japanese Running. Adharand Finn, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is it, Tom, for edition 300 of the Monocle Weekly.
300. That's a big number.
Well, what a good grouping of guests we had. Richard King's very cool. A very interesting man.
I guess so far as to say I was quite inspired by our guests today.
Yeah, yeah, it's cool.
Inspired to participate in the democratic process.
Will you be voting now that Jeremy Deller has told you to? Were you going to anyway?
Probably going to anyway, but that's absolutely
sealed. Spurred you on.
Signed and sealed.
Yeah.
Maybe it's about to, you know, brush off some dusty old vinyl. Not a euphemism, because of Richard's counsel.
Yeah.
And then maybe
it's a very good book, that, actually.
Very, very good. Yeah. And then maybe, you know, hit the dusty trail in my running shoes again.
I like Mr. Finn's book, but I'm not entirely sure whether these shoes, which are a popular brand of running shoe, whether they're going to be used in anger that much. I don't know.
Oh, I see.
I mean, I tend to think you could run, but then another bus will be along in a minute.
That's a fair point.
I mean, that's not like a philosophy. I mean, don't put that on a t-shirt. It's not.
Well, no, because I was just thinking that was quite zen.
That was a zen pause there. Let's thank our friends behind the glass. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio manager was Claire Urban, and our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week. Maybe same time, maybe same place. Definitely different people. I've got all of those things wrong, but you can put them into a phrase that you are familiar with. For the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Happy Easter.